Breaking the Panel is made possible by you and other listeners just as awesome as you are. If you want to support the show and get a little something in return, just go to patreon.com/breakingthepanel. We do appreciate the help. These days, the comic book owns pop culture. You'll find it all in the panel of your favorite comic book. Us, we're living the comic's life. We're Breaking the Panel.
And welcome to Breaking the Panel, your weekly source for all things that is awesome, or maybe, you know, some things that are disappointing, but we cover it in a really great way. When it has to do with the comic books, the geek world, and everything that we love. I am the rock god of podcasting, Charles McFall. Riding shotgun is the daddy of this show, Paul Klotz.
Hey.
You get introduced as daddy, and you're like, hey. Hey, you guys. Anyway, no.
Coming I hate that up, guy.
And again, he was back last week. I'm just excited that he's back again this week. Chris Wisdom.
I get so tired of calling shotgun and still getting stuck in the backseat.
If you wouldn't leave, you wouldn't get stuck in the backseat, my friend. That's all there is to it. Real quickly, after this show tonight, I am going to record another show. I'm going to show up on a friend of mine's show called The Blind Monkey Show. And we're going to talk about Batman origins, but not the way that you think, like comic book origins, but how we, as podcasters, came across Batman and grew up and the different flavors and those kind of things. So it's going to be a really interesting, I hope it's going to be a really interesting discussion, because I'm going to be slightly inebriated for it, although they don't know that yet. So check that out, The Blind Monkey Show. I will Twitter it and Facebook it and all that jazz when that show, that episode comes out, and you can catch me there.
So your Batman Secret Origin involves finding a show called DC On Screen sometime in 2015 and being introduced to the character?
I will have you know, I had my Batman tattoo long before DC On Screen ever came around.
Yeah, but you thought it said hope in Chinese, so.
No, I really thought it said Michael Bay is God, but you know. All right. Now, Chris, I gotta give you props. When I get pulled away for different things with work or other things with family, I don't always think about doing anything for the network, much less extra content. You're in the middle of the freaking desert. Things are happening. Stuff is exploding. You're running drills, all this jazz. And in the middle of all this, you and your buddies get into a conversation about what?
About Blade versus Buffy. Now, this conversation kind of evolved. I got brought into it secondhand. It happened while we were out on the training exercises. I got brought into in the last couple days of it. So a couple soldiers in the unit, one of them Sergeant Goforth, and then Specialist Clark. Specialist Clark firmly believes that Buffy could take Blade. Goforth, I think more than anything, just to razzle, just to give him the jazz, you know. Chose Blade, but I have to hands down go with Blade on either side. The evolution in the conversation went from originally it was one-on-one, and then it was to include the Scooby gang, and I'm like, so it's crew versus crew? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, hands down, the Avengers are going to wipe the floor with them. I said, right. I will just limit it to Doctor Strange, and your Willow argument is null and void.
Now, you're saying Scooby gang in just a generic term of they all work together, as opposed to, because, you know, Michelle Geller was in the Scooby-Doo movie.
Right.
What threw me off.
I believe that's how Buffy and the gang refer to themselves, is the Scooby gang.
Oh, you know what? They might. I was never a huge... I mean, I've watched it. I think it's good work. But I was never a huge Buffy fan at the time. So you probably are right there.
And I don't know that I wouldn't be a Buffy fan. It's just not something I ever got into. I remember I really liked the movie. And that was where I was going at first. Because I was like, okay, so movie Buffy versus movie Blade. The most difficult opponent she had was a Paul Rubens who went, ooh.
Yeah. Greatest after credit singer ever, I will say.
So, but that's the debate. And I kind of want to know where you guys sit. And I apologize to Frank Allen. Our friendship was beautiful and it burned bright while it lasted. But you're gone, buddy. I'm sorry.
and the reason I prefaced it the way I did about doing content is because Chris put up a live Facebook video with the discussion and prepped it for the show and everything. I'm like, dude, you need a promotion or something. That was spot on, great content right there. So Klotz, And that's where you can go. You can go and find out Breaking the Panel, and that's where Frank Allen went and unfriended all of us because we're on the other side of this debate, I think. But Klotz, okay, Buffy versus Blade. What do you think?
I feel like this is barely even a real question.
I kind of do too, to be honest.
This question is so awkward it would make Blade blush. I like both characters, okay? Let me say that. I do enjoy the Buffyverse. It's tongue-in-cheek. It's fun. But no, Blade is... Buffy is a teenage girl who is also a vampire slayer. Blade is a vampire slayer...
Who's a vampire?
Who happens to be a vampire, and that's pretty much it. Like, he doesn't have any boy drama getting in the way of his killing instinct, or girl drama, really. That one chick burnt to a crisp. spoilers. You know, I mean, that's the thing, is it's just like, there's really no competition. One of them's a bloodthirsty killer, and the other one is just like a thirsty killer.
It was the way the show was. It was a little campy. It just didn't have that edge feel to it. Maybe in the 90s at the time, because it was edgy to have a lesbian on screen. It's edgy to have vampires on screen. It's edgy to have witches and all that. But Seth Green, I love Seth Green. But Seth Green is a werewolf. It really should have been Scrappy Doo when he changed. You know, I'm just saying. It's his character, his whole being is funny, scrappy, witty, not a fighter, and he turns into this badass werewolf. I think your character translates even with lycanthropy, my friend. But yeah, when I heard that, I was like, Kris Kristofferson. I mean, Blade didn't even need a crew. You put the entire Buffy crew against Blade and Kris Kristofferson before he got killed. Spoilers. Done. I mean, that's where all the gadgets came from. That's where all it was so cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I even handicapped it and went Blade Trinity crew versus your Scooby gang. And I'm pretty sure there's still
okay. You got Deadpool in there. Come on, you can't lose.
It's
just an album.
I don't know.
Deadpool and an Olympic quality archer in that group.
Yeah, you can't beat that.
Go ahead, Paul, sorry.
I was just going to say, not a lot of people really know this, but Jessica Biel, when training for Blade Trinity, as bad as that movie was, she was legitimately a good archer, and she trained to Olympic standards. Like, pretty much everybody who worked with her said that she could, you know, compete and expect to do well.
I would disagree with Klaus. I actually enjoyed that movie. The only bad scene was when they were waiting on her to put her stupid playlist together. That was crap. Hunter King. I mean, how cool name is that? Hunter King.
The only bad scene. The only bad scene. Error.
Error. All right. Off the debates of three.
You broke me.
Still. It's still, okay, let's just, for sake of argument, say it was the worst Blade film ever made or worst
there
film.
There is
I don't know.
Argument that is definitive. Shut Everyone it. Knows that.
And still, you can agree that that movie still would stomp the Buffy crew.
That team would. Now, we didn't just, you know, sit back on fanboy laurels and just say, because we did our fair amount of Google boxing and doing the research on the interwebs, right? So when we found, we were looking at strength and speed metrics, and Buffy's no slouch. She really isn't. I think a lot of that isn't necessarily portrayed in the show, but in the season 11 comic books afterwards. I believe she's killed Dracula. So you almost had to, that's a wash on both parts because both have killed Dracula.
Sure.
Strength, I think they were pretty close. I think Blade's a little bit stronger, and then speed. We found where Buffy has dodged shotgun blast at point blank range. And that was Clark's. He's like, look how much faster she is. Look at that. And then we found an entry where Blade has dodged laser beams at point blank range. And I'm pretty sure that those travel at, I don't know, the speed of light.
Now, I've got an honest question, comic book or otherwise. Does Buffy heal? Blade heals.
Yeah, Blade. I don't know what her healing capabilities are. I would imagine that she's got some sort of healing factor. I'm not sure. I'm sure Clark will comment under this episode, hopefully. But
you know what, Clark? Email us. I would love to hear from you. BTP at giantsizeteamup.com.
I did tell him to have one prepped, send into the show when we did it.
So we all strongly come off Team Blade here, no matter how you cut it.
Perhaps but, you know, Frank can send something in as well.
Nah, he's a criminal. We don't want to hear from him. No, I love Frank and everybody in Australia who's listening. And he was strongly Team Buffy. And he kind of drew a really hard line in the sand, right? Like, no friend of mine would ever pick Team Blade, or what was it? Something along those lines?
Yeah, if you pick Team Blade, we can't be friends anymore or something.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I will make sure to tell you, Frank, that I'm sending you a NES classic that can't be gotten anymore, and then it'll never show up, and I'll just blame it on Australian mail, to say. So speaking of those kind of things, I wrote it this way because, you know, who doesn't remember Sega?
Sega.
You know, exactly. So Sega is getting into the market, right, to compete with NES Classic and Atari Classic and all this other stuff. Are they really competing? No, I think they're hashtag winning already, because Sega forever coming to iOS, Android, and Android stuff for free. For free. Man, they announced at E3 this week they're going to release games like Altered Beast, one of my favorites, Comic Zone, another one of my favorites.
Rise from your grave.
Sonic, which was, everybody liked Sonic. You know, it was fine, but I like some of the more offbeat games on Sega. They plan to release a new game every 2 weeks until eventually incorporating titles from every Sega console, from the SG-1000 to the Dreamcast. It's called Sega Forever as the project name. Oh, my God. You guys, you excited about this?
Oh, absolutely. I actually already downloaded Kid Chameleon and Comic Zone.
Nice.
And that's that story is just talking about the mobile. You're yeah, tracking on the three is. Different systems they've got out too, right? They're doing three retro systems. There's one that comes loaded with, it might be 30 games. I can't remember. That it's just a Sega Genesis, just like the NES Classic. We'll just call it, I can't remember what it's called, so we'll just call it a Sega Genesis Classic. Sure. And then there's the Sega Genesis Classic Plus, which has a cartridge port, so you can play your friggin' Sega games on it.
Nice.
And I believe it supports original controllers as well. And then there's a portable system coming out. So yeah, hashtag winning is pretty much an accurate statement.
That is really cool. Now here for the iOS, they said, or for the Android, the mobile stuff, they haven't gone in and messed with the ROM, so these are faithful ports, faithful emulations, and they're going to work like they originally worked. And they weren't designed for touchscreen. And you can buy a cheap Bluetooth controller, and you can even do stuff with the TV. You know, if you Chromecast it or have the Apple TV or whatever, you can actually play it on the TV as well. And it's free for the mobile stuff. That's awesome. Now, there's an option to pay. This is in pounds, $2 pounds. So that'd be about $5, roughly, U.S., to get an ad-free version for each game. But no thanks. I'll just take the free version, watch the ads, and get my booty handed to me, because kids, yeah, here's the old man on the porch moment, Klotz. Kids these days do not understand difficulty levels at all. God, man.
They play ghosts and ghouls.
Yeah, no kidding. If they play any of the stuff, they'll get it. It's like, what do you mean you have to start over? No, you have to start over. If you don't beat the level, you have to start over. You know?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's a thing. Like,
yeah.
Young gamers don't understand when games weren't good. And I don't mean that the games weren't fun and the games weren't good in a at the time sense. I'm saying, like, we have 30 plus years of game theory behind game design now. And we know that there's a whole bunch of stuff that was done, you know, when Sega and Nintendo were first, you know, getting into everybody's homes and getting into everybody's hands, there was a lot of stuff that wouldn't pass by modern standards, even in like a mobile game, you know what I mean? Like a phone game or something. Just a lot of mechanics and stuff, and difficulty stuff without any kind of scaling. So yeah, like the Contra games are kind of legendary for people.
Oh yes,
yeah, those games are like unplayable for most people. But yeah, no. So we've learned a lot. We've come a long way. But the subsequent result of that is kids are in for some brutal surprises when they play the classics.
I believe this could have only been a Super Nintendo game. I honestly, it's so far long ago, I don't remember if it was only the one system. But Battletoads is the one that always pops in my head. People talk about, there's that dungeon game today that is super hardcore. There's two versions out. I'm blanking on the name. But you start off as this soldier of sorts, and it's an open world thing, but if you die, I mean, you lose all your stuff right there. You have to make your way all the way back to your body to get your gear again. I can't think of it. It's
Dark Souls.
Yeah, I think it's Dark Souls. And so that's a specific type of dungeon crawler that is supposed to be extra hard, and they think, oh my god, Dark Souls. No, you little people that I don't want to say four little words at right now. Try playing Battletoads on that stupid zapper bike level towards the end, and it is so twitchy, and if you don't memorize the pattern and you die, you have to start over. Like, oh my god, that gave me rage issues that I had to get counseling for. I hated that level.
You tell us all how you really feel.
I can show you on the cartridge where that game touched me.
Battletoads was an NES game, by the way.
Was it? Okay. I thought it might have been just NES.
Battletoads is semi-legendary for being one of the most valuable Nintendo carts.
Love the game, man. Love the characters. I actually beat it. I think I had to use a Game Genie or something to get past that level. Or I think I might have had a friend that was one of those guys who just could memorize the super zippy level and get past it. And I did end up beating that game, but that level, I mean, rage tears is the only thing I can come close to explaining how that level treated me. It was horrible. Now, Chris, you don't remember us talking about the NES Classic being, as I call it, short-sheeted, or I don't remember exactly how it went down with our conversation with the three of us, but we hypothesized then that Nintendo is shorting the market on their NES because they said, oh, we're not going to make any more. Sorry, guys. And we're like, there's a Super NES Classic coming out. There has to be. And sure enough, Super NES has been announced, and everybody's going crazy. Oh my god, they announced this in SNES Classic. Well, that was, if you pay attention to the market, that was a no-brainer. But that's not what we really want to talk about, is it? We want to talk about how they're kind of shorting the market, making a collector's edition just by simply not making enough of them. That's my take on it. Go ahead, guys.
Well, okay, so what prompted this conversation is that we were going to talk about that this was officially announced because it just happened today.
Yeah, it did just get announced.
And I responded with a resounding meh. Because when we talked about this before, we talked about the situation with the NES Classic and how it was basically, people call them scalpers, but the profiteers, entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them, people who were looking to buy them at retail and then flip them for a profit. We talked about that before, and what fueled that whole market was the scarcity, because Nintendo underproduced. Yeah. And then ultimately, the last time we talked about this topic, we talked about the fact that there was a lot of frustration over the fact that they announced that they weren't making anymore. And so here we are, and it's round two, fight. And the reason I am completely unimpressed by this is because I expect it to be more of the same. Now, one of the things I will praise them on is they have Star Fox 2 on this, which has never had an official release before this. So that was a pretty slick move. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was nice for them to make an official release for it. But the thing is that if they're going to underproduce this again, I have zero interest. Most people that I see online, like my friends on Facebook, people I encounter on Reddit and such, their response to this whole thing is, I can just go buy a Raspberry Pi and basically flash an emulator onto it and put any of these games I want, or all of them, you know, and you can put the NES games, you can put the SNES games, you can put the Sega games, you know, you can put pretty much anything you want onto a Raspberry Pi or other microcomputer, and there are kits you can get online to make them look like consoles. You can take a, you can go, you know, buy a secondhand busted console.
Yeah.
Your favorite one, you, with a little bit of, you know, elbow grease and some ingenuity, you can go in, take out the guts, you know, drill some extra holes or whatever to run new cables and whatnot, and install a microcomputer inside of it, and it looks like the real deal, and then you just hook it up and it's, you know, got all your emulated games on it. So there's really not a good reason for these things to be so scarce other than, you know, Nintendo's manufacturing policy and the fact that, you know, people want something with that official stamp on it. And so my response is, do you not like money, Nintendo? Because because there's people who want to give you the money, you know, and you're, when your product is short printed like that, they're not giving you the money. You're getting the money for the number that you printed. That's great and all. But then a whole bunch of money is going into somebody else's pocket and not yours. And I feel like that's a big mistake. So another part of that, and I'm going to let Chris jump in here in a minute because I'm sure he's got a counterpoint. Another part of this whole conversation is the fact that E3 did not have any Switch virtual console news, and people are really looking for virtual console news. And so we still don't have any virtual console news. And people want that for the Switch because there's a, still a fair amount of concern about the Switch being a, you know, future dead product. Not right now, it's fine, you know, because the handful of games that are available for it are quite good. People are enjoying the system. Breath of the Wild, you know, being one of the best, being one of the best Zelda games of all time, but also being one of the best, you know, action RPG games of all time as well. So yeah, there's a lot of complexity to this whole issue. My big thing is, if they repeat what they just did, it's only going to further condemn them in the eyes of a lot of people, and I don't think that's the right play. And now I yield my soapbox to Chris.
All right, so I don't disagree at all, because like, this is the position I took when the NES Classic shortages happened, both runs, because I don't know why you only do two runs of that. That makes no sense. I've never been on Nintendo's side of this. My problem is, it's hard to say that you're not upset with the scalpers themselves, because you are, you should be. Like, I understand that all they're doing is they're working in the system that was created by Nintendo. For whatever reason, Nintendo just decided to operate that in that system. And, you know, when I go to Toys R Us every year, there's that same section, and there are end caps at Walgreens and Target that have those plug-and-play systems on them. They sell well, incredibly well, especially during the holidays. I don't understand why Nintendo doesn't think there's a market for the NES and the SNES at the same time, year after year after year. But there's a greed factor with people that it bugs me. And Charles, you're coming right off of this issue with Pokemon Go and trying to get tickets for the Pokemon Go Fest in Chicago. Scalpers are bad people. Like that's the only thing I can say. And it's not like there are people that try to dress it up with words like, oh, we're speculators. You know, we figure out what's going to be the hot toy for the season, and we go and we buy $5,000 worth of it and turn that into $20,000 or $50,000 because we charge that many more times, versus these parents that they're going to hold hostage at the holidays, or people that. And the position that you guys took on the show is that you legitimately, where Pokemon Go Fest is specifically involved, is that you are taking that
opportunity
from somebody, because this is the first one. There's only going to be one first one. There may be some after it, but they're not going to be this one.
Well, and there's no guarantee. So to recap that real quick, I have no problems when an Xbox One or PlayStation 4 comes out, and for giggles, let's say Chris says, I'm going to take my $800 to $900, and you know, the next gen might even be over $1,000 to get the first off-the-shelf one. And I'm going to go stand in line, and I'm going to invest all this money, and I'm going to turn around, and I'm going to put it on eBay to see if somebody buys it. Put it at bids. I mean, some start legit at zero and go up. That's open market, okay? And even the ones that do hold a hostage at holidays, as a parent, I can say you're an idiot. Who, if you pay double, triple the price. One, if you really wanted it that bad for your kid, go get in line and take the $800 and see if you can get it. If you can't, sorry. But here's the thing, what we know about those major consoles is if you freaking wait, there will be more very quickly with PlayStation and Xbox, typically. Not Nintendo. But I can tell you a story about having to get my freaking Wii U, taking forever to get that because of Nintendo shortage. But with events, live events, there's never a guarantee there'll be a second one. And with this particular market, this is a middle ground in between getting a console that you know they'll back up, like the Switch. If the I don't know if it sold out or not, but if the Switch sold out, you know they're in the long game with that. They're not just going to make 500,000 and be done, because then they can't keep making more games. They need more people to buy more games. If you buy the Switch ahead of time and decide to sell it, that is an open market, because some idiot will come along at Christmas and, okay, he's gonna have it. I'll give you $2,000 for that. Okay, you're an idiot. When I have to start my bid at zero or even at the price I paid and you bid it up, that is not the scalper or me or you. That's the idiot bidding it up. But when you take a NES Classic and, like you said, you buy three or four of them, you sweep them all off the shelf just to turn around and resell them. I mean, how's that? This is an honest question, Chris. How's that different than, I don't know if you saw it, but I saw Klotz found a Walgreens limited edition Funko Pop that he did his research, and apparently there's a great aftermarket for it. He found it. I don't know if you swept the shelves. I'm not going to put actions into your words, sir. But you said, hey, there's an aftermarket for it. I found it. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to put an aftermarket and see what happens. Because I found it when somebody else couldn't.
I'm actually going to keep it. But I was I was delighted to see that it would hold more than
value
beyond what I paid. See,
but if you were to resell it, I want to say on that one, if he was to resell that, how's it different? You know,
and I understand what you're saying, but then you need to answer that same question in reverse.
Okay.
So if scalpers are good and if they're bad in one instance, how are they not bad in the other? It's a greed thing. So, and maybe when you're talking,
I agree, there is a greed thing. There is.
When it comes to toys, especially, like, you're talking to a guy that was a store manager at KB Toys back in the day. If there's a certain sect of people that I grew to hate quickly, probably even more so quickly than unattended children, it was the toy speculators, the guys that come in for their Hot Wheels, for the treasure hunt cars, or big thing. When I was working there, that was when the Marvel Legends line first came out. So the Daredevil in the yellow suit, maskless Wolverine, things like that. Those caused problems because you would have guys in my store like rattling the gate before it opened. Are you guys open? You guys open? Watching their watch that may be 5 minutes ahead of mine and telling me that I'm not opening on time. You know, so there's, because they have this sense of entitlement because they know that they're going to get this and they're going to go sell it at a certain premium price on eBay or what have you. Mm-hmm. And that's their right, and I'm impeding on their business. Like, well, No.
When they start harassing you, they're impeding on your business now.
Exactly. But it's just a microcosm of that greed argument. Like, when is enough enough? Do you really need, on a ticket to an event that costs you $26, do you need to put it on eBay for over $2,000?
No, and that's ridiculous. So my wife and I have that conversation every time a new console comes out, because I'm like, man, I'd really like to get $600 or $800, go stand in line, spend the day and a half, 2 days in line, hopefully get one, but then I would turn around and sell it so I could give my kids a good Christmas. But you know what it started at? Either zero and just see where it went, or at what I paid for it and see where it went. But I would never say, okay, buy it now for $5,000 and that's it. And if I paid $20 for my ticket, okay, we have this happen every year at the Georgia Renaissance Festival on a smaller scale. Every year when we go there, we have a friend of ours who works it. They give us a ticket valued at $20 because that's what it takes to, or $22 now, I think, because that's what it takes to get in the door. The ticket specifically says, because they're kind of assholes about it, do not resell, do not give away, do not do. Okay, dude, nobody cares enough about the Georgia Ren Fest that you're going to sell out and there's lines of people being turned away. That never happens. But there's always somebody there who says, hey, we've got an extra ticket. Do you want it? They never try to scalp it. They never try to jack up the price, because you could literally just walk up, pay full price right at the door. It never sells out. Mm-hmm. And that's a company that's way too concerned about it. But if I spent $20 for tickets to a concert, to Pokemon Go Fest, I spent $20 to get my ticket, and I can't go, I would say, hey, I've got a ticket for $20. Who wants it? But I'm smart enough to put it on eBay, start it at $20, and let it maybe go $30, $40 if somebody really wants it. But you're right. When you jack it up, I don't know what the percentage is, Klotz, 3,000% to get it to $2,000? You know, that's crazy. Well, stupid. All right.
So I'm going to jump in. I'm going to respond here. I'm going to start by qualifying this with my history in this industry. I've been a game store manager. I've been a private dealer of collectibles and stuff like Magic the Gathering and HeroClix and everything else under the sun. And what I'm going to say here is I don't jive with Chris's argument. There is such a thing as greed. Yeah, obviously. And it sucks when the market is beholden to the scarcity of something, and particularly if it's important. But ultimately what we're talking about here are luxury goods. We're not talking about essentials. Like, we're not talking about gasoline or food or utilities or anything like that. Something that you need to survive, you need to get to work, you need, you know, any put food on your table, any of that kind of stuff. We're talking about pleasure items. That's it. Pure luxury. And that's the thing, is like, some of this, so some things are legitimately scarce and some things are artificially scarce. And I won't put the onus on the people who look for the opportunities to play into what the market's willing to bear. Because that's the thing. You know, you can list anything you want on eBay for any price. You can list your dirty gym socks on eBay if you want, and nobody's going to pay you for them. But if you, you know, can prove that they're like, you know, Chris Wisdom's dirty gym socks, somebody might pay a few bucks for them. You know what I mean?
And I'm the name dropper.
It's all about the perceived value of the potential buyer. Nobody's going to pay anything if they don't think it's worth it. And there are plenty of people out there who think X amount of dollars is totally worth it for something, whether it be a piece of sports memorabilia, for example, or whether it be a signed headshot, or a, you know, a rookie card for baseball, or, you know, a rare Magic card, all of that stuff. It's all luxury, and it's all about, you know, there people like myself, and because I've done this, I do it on a, you know, not on a weekly basis, but I do it on a fairly regular basis. We look for those opportunities to make money where there is a demand for something that's not necessarily available widely or not available in all markets. And I've seen it in pretty much everything that you could possibly imagine collecting. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, I don't disagree with that, but I guess my problem then is you can't be mad at Nintendo. You should be pumping Nintendo's business practices because it helps perpetuate and stand up this market that you have no problem with.
You misunderstand, though. I can condemn Nintendo for that, because I can say that the problem that you perceive with scalpers or resellers or whatever you want to call them is because the company that's manufacturing the product doesn't have adequate policy or plans in place to meet the demand of that product at the normal, at the pre-agreed upon retail price.
And I get what you're saying, but what I'm saying is, if you have no problem with the actions of the people, then you have no problems with the people enabling them.
Now, it sounds,
because you're accepting of it because they're luxury items, and people will pay what the market will bear. So you have no problem with the supply that is supplied.
But you're not listening to the argument I made earlier. I specifically made the argument earlier that I said to Nintendo, why don't you like money?
No, and I get that, and I agree.
No, you're arguing nonsense.
Because you are okay with scalpers. You're okay with these people that will hold people hostage for no other reason than the supply. Supply is low.
I'm going to call you out for...
Hold on.
I'm going to call you out for using extremely hyperbolic language there. Holding people hostage? It's a luxury item, Chris. Let's be real here. Okay.
Charles. Explain the tickets and tell me how close that was to holding people hostage.
We're not talking about Pokemon Go. This is a Pokemon Go podcast because I don't know anything about that issue.
To me, there's a no-win argument here. If you argue they're all the same, then there's a no-win argument, and I would have to be forced ethically to side with you. Now, I say there are two different arguments. I blame Niantic for the tickets because they had no cap on it. And I even mentioned this on Twitter. I still stand by my statement. I saw a picture on Twitter from a legitimate person who has a channel about Pokemon Go. They bought like 10 of them. Now they're going to turn around. They have a crew, is what they said. So they, you know, they're going to take their show crew, whatever crew means. They also said they promised some giveaways to their Twitter channel or their Facebook channel. So this is a legit way to get people to follow you, blah, blah, blah. You invested the money. You're actually going to get people to have the experience. You're not scalping it. I still went, there should have been a limit. Now, if I want to bring my family, and unfortunately for me, across the United States, family means four people. Well, I got six people in my family, so that I have to buy extra stuff all the time. However, I get that, and I get as a company, you're trying to make sure the widest possible thing happens. Niantic should add a limit of four or whatever limit they wanted. They start off with no limit. As people started buying massive amounts, the system shut down. I mean, from what I understand, people watching it, they started to get kicked out of their baskets. Their shopping carts didn't fulfill. The limit went to, I think, five, then four, then three. And at one point, I personally saw it at one, but then it still said sold out.
Well,
so that's very common.
That's all common in tickets, because that happened to Ticketmaster and other ticket vendors as well.
And it's an event, which is an one-time experience. Even if you say Metallica is going to be in Atlanta, then they're going to be in Tennessee. Well, the Atlanta experience will be different because they're human beings, whatever. Scalpers still get the tickets, and I still don't get to go. But Metallica is charging 126 tickets for the cheap seats, so I can't go anyway. Thank you, Metallica. Appreciate you. But when it came to Niantic trying to make an event, they didn't handle it right. So scalpers bought the tickets and turned around immediately. I mean, literally, when I saw that it was sold out 30 minutes after they launched the tickets on eBay, at that point, there was two sellers, one at $250, one at $500. And that's really crappy, but I didn't blame the resellers then. Not till when we did the show for Pokemon Go, and I pulled it up right then, and there was a good 151 resellers. And on average, they were charging $500 a pass. That's ridiculous. I still blame Niantic because it is a seller's market. When you start talking about Nintendo, I spent almost a year and a half trying to get, I think it was the Wii. It's either the Wii or the Wii U. I think it was the Wii.
It was the Wii. There were no supply problems with the Wii U.
Oh, with the Wii. Okay, so it's the Wii. And Nintendo has done this forever in a day. I mean, this is how they roll.
They've been doing this for at least a decade.
At least. And my problem with Nintendo is put the stuff out and let me shut up and take my money, but you won't. And I refuse to play in the aftermarket when it comes to these consoles because I know if I wait long enough, I'll get it. With the NES Classic and the SNES Classic, I don't care. If you get it, you get it. But if you really want it, and it's to me, it's a false collector's item, right? And Nintendo, we know they're going to put out like 500. Or 5,000, whatever low number would be for the world for that. They're going to put out a low number, and now it's an automatic scramble to get it for $80 in September before it hits the eBay shelves for $800. Mm-hmm. And I'm not mad at the scalpers. I'm mad at Nintendo for it, personally.
Well, so I guess here's what I want to know then. Why are you mad at Nintendo? Because the difference in what you're talking about with Niantic and Nintendo is those aren't direct sales by Nintendo. So shouldn't you be mad at the retailers that don't necessarily always put limits on it? Or the limit they put is five per customer.
No, they don't.
I don't understand why all the hate is on Nintendo
in
this
argument. Can I jump in here and get a moment without any jumping on me? Let me explain this. Okay. So first of all, we're talking about two entirely different scenarios. A ticket for an event is an event, like Charles said, is an experience. You cannot replicate that event and that experience. You can have multiple events, but you know, you can never, there can only be so many seats to any show or play or whatever at any given time. You know what I mean? The difference between a ticket for an event and a console, which is basically just a microcomputer inside a shell, is that the market already has competition for that microcomputer inside the shell that is actually way cheaper, widely available, and fully customizable. So the only thing that is getting people to buy a NES Classic or an SNES Classic is the fact that people want to support Nintendo and want to support the direct product itself. So my frustration with Nintendo is that they're producing a product that is not meeting demand, and other people are profiteering off them. I'm not mad at the profiteers. I'm mad at Nintendo for not taking advantage of the situation and meeting the demands of the market, because this isn't an exclusive item. There's nothing special about it other than the fact that it is something that they're producing with these titles on it at this given time. Now, if you want to talk about ticket sales, there's been, you know, the last 15 years in particular, there's been a whole conversation about ticket sales. I always talk about Pearl Jam, you know, being one of the first national acts in music that stood up against Ticketmaster and said, you know, yeah, what Ticketmaster does is wrong, and we don't like that. We don't think it's fair. We don't like the fact that, you know, hundreds of our tickets end up in the hands of scalping, you know, groups and individuals, and, you know, our fans can't come see us, and we see a bunch of empty seats at a sold out show because the prices get raised, so, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so they took it on themselves, and they handle their own ticket sales now. Now, they're a pretty big band, but they had to absorb a lot of cost and a lot of risk to set up that infrastructure within their own organization, you know, their own corporation or whatever it happens to be, to handle all of that themselves. And they also had to take a lot of risk because they didn't get to book a lot of venues that were real tight with Ticketmaster for a long time because they, you know, a line was drawn in the sand. There was war, you know, all-out war over the issue. Events are, they are luxury items, but they are invariably different than a physical product that's going to sit in your house. And, you know, so the console is mass produced. We know that, right? It's fundamentally not any different than a Wii, a Wii U, an Xbox. There's nothing special about it outside of the fact that they only want to make it for X amount of time. That's where my frustration lies. It's like, it's not a collector's edition or anything like that, really, because there's nothing special about it. It's just a tiny little thing. You know what I mean? I think they should produce to try to meet demand. And if they find that they're selling out everywhere in a short window, that's call for a reorder. You know what I mean? That's call for another production run.
And that's what I was going to say when I was jumping in. Was my issue with Nintendo is, we know when Xbox One launches, they're going to have as many units on the shelf as they can, and demand actually wipes the shelves off. And some of that is scalpers, yeah. But I've never been mad at the scalpers or the Xbox company for that, Microsoft being the Xbox, I know. Because they legitimately produced what they can meet the projected demand for the sales, and they're continually producing right after that. Same with PlayStation. My problem with Nintendo is how they treated the NES Classic. They put two minimal runs out where it sold out, pre-sold out, before it ever hit the shelves, and then they cut it off. And I never wanted one. I don't care. It's not like I'm personally, I didn't get one, so I'm bitter. I don't care. Phil from Botch has one. He'll let me play it if I won. You know, he's probably going to message the show going, no, I won't. but that's, Nintendo has shorted the market over and over again, and they do weird stuff. Like, there's nothing wrong with the Wii U tablet. There was nothing wrong with the Wii motion controls, but it was non-standard. It was out of the market, and for me, I've always seen Nintendo as the family console, and they brand themselves as the family console if you're five families in the world, because they don't they don't include enough crap to be a family console, right? They don't include enough controllers.
Well, they're the family-friendly console.
Yeah. Their big campaign when they were launching the Wii U was at Mario World, Super Mario World, whatever it's called. I actually have it now. That has been out for like 6 years or whatever. And they show four people playing, and that was their big push. And they send you one controller, and that's the tablet. That's it. You know, and I know that's a market thing, but I'm nitpicking, but I'm saying they short the market intentionally. And when you announce Super NES Classic coming out, okay, who cares? Because you're only going to make 5,000, we're done.
So what I will say, because I do want to fully qualify what I'm trying to say here, is I understand, and I said this before when we talked about the NES Classic, I understand the desire to not overproduce something that is under demanded. You know, because that's what happened with the Wii U, right? The Wii was immensely popular because it was so different than the other offerings from everybody else. Nobody else had the motion controls at the time. Nobody else had the family friendly and, you know, the action, or not action, but movement oriented gameplay, all that stuff. People really liked the fact that, you know, your kids could play this and they're freaking out and flailing around and getting exercise. You know, parents could do it. I mean, Wii Fit was a thing. So
it was.
They didn't produce enough to meet demand, but they kept producing it, you know, and eventually the supply caught up with the demand, and then everybody had a Wii. And then they said, okay, well, now we want to update the system a little bit. We want to add this new tablet feature, and we want to
throw in HD finally.
Right, right, exactly. And so they do the Wii U, but they just kind of like they misstepped because there wasn't really a lot of games on offer for it that made it worth the buy. People were confused because that's the other thing is the marketing was really silly. Like they called it the Wii U, but a lot of people were like, well, I already have a Wii. You know what I mean? So there was confusion and all that, but it actually is its own console. You know, it literally has nothing to do with the actual Wii. So, you know, they overproduced and nobody cared. And so that's why you saw Wii U's sit on shelves for months and years and then get liquidated later on. And so I understand being cautious about that because that's something we see in the gaming, you know, tabletop gaming as well. Fantasy Flight Games is probably the biggest outside of like Wizards of the Coast that makes Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons. Fantasy Flight Games is the new top dog in tabletop game and game making and just coming out with they have Star Wars as an IP. The X-Wing miniature game is huge. They have a couple of card games. They just released a dice game called Star Wars Destiny. That game has seen issues because the first set was really short printed and it also got stuck on the boat coming from China. And so it was really expensive to find the cards for that, the cards and dice early on. And people were frustrated with that. So people left the game because of supply issues. And they've been reprinting it since then, but they pulled the same thing recently where they're like, we're done. And I think it's a little bit of a different issue for them because I think they literally can't get the time to print the product to meet the demand, you know, of that first set, because I think a lot of the Chinese printers are so backed up right now with board games and tabletop gaming being as big as it is right now. I feel like the manufacturing industry in China is overloaded with orders for all of this. And Fantasy Flight's a big company that has a lot of games on order, you know, from a lot of different IPs, and they can't really they can't risk doing a reorder on that first set without potentially it just sitting on shelves. You know what I mean? So, you know, they've taken some flack for that and they've taken some backlash. They've lost some customers over it, but they said they've come right out and said, we underprinted because we did not want to overorder and have all of this product sitting around and have the game flop or have, you know, like it's sitting at distributors and all that. Cause that's a big issue for them. It causes a lot of back end problems. In the case of the NES and the SNES Classics, that's not what happened. It wasn't like, okay, well, we put out a cautious initial run and then we did our reorder and we'll probably keep doing our reorders based on sales volume. The NES has sold out every time it's come out and it sells out right away. It's not like any stores are sitting on a couple cases of this for a few weeks. It's like, it's gone, you know? So, yeah. You know, build to meet that demand because you can. And that's the big difference. Now, and I'm not defending to touch back on the scalper thing. Being an online reseller is one thing. I'm not behind scalping event tickets because I think that's really the ways that they go about it are really underhanded and it takes all agency out of people's hands. Because the thing about going to a store, like despite Chris's frustration with the guys rattling his gate, is you have to go physically sit in the store. Like you got to go to the store at opening. You got to go in, rummage through the stuff, grab the thing that you desire. You know what I mean? You got to do all the work.
And you got to deal with that 21-year-old wisdom manager not letting you in.
That's not 100% accurate, though, either, Paul. And you know that because I had guys that worked for me at KB Toys that would, before a product would hit shelves, before I became a store manager, there was an assistant manager that worked at the store with me that would buy this shit.
Oh, well,
he'd sell it on his own.
And that's underhanded.
So what I'm talking about. So what are the degrees?
But that's also the violation of a company's policies. Every retail company, I've worked for my fair share of retail companies. Yeah. Every company I've ever worked for has had a distinct policy that everything has to hit the floor and employees are not allowed to buy something until like their break when they're actually off the clock and they have to go out like a regular customer and pick it up.
With KB Toys, the only time that applied was a Black Friday sale.
And who's not around anymore?
Yeah, well, no, right, absolutely. But what I'm saying is, so there are degrees here. And, and not only to mention the fact that we have spoken of them in terms of scalpers and profiteers. And at what point are those positive terms? Never. The definition of profiteering is, I believe, would probably include the word unethical. So when you throw that word out to describe these people, you already understand that they're not coming from the high ground.
But is it?
Well, I'll tell you what.
We
could go around in circles, and it's great. It is great, but I think we need to, because our audience is doing the same thing. They're arguing with it, and it just keeps going on. How about this? How about we sum up the point from each of us, and then we'll move on to some other stuff, so we can each feel like we expressed our unedited opinion, and let the audience pick and choose where they fall, and we'll move forward.
I think I've spoken about it at length. I think it's pretty clear.
Chris, go ahead and sum up your personal stance on this.
Nintendo needs to print more or produce more, but people need to not be dicks.
That's fair. That's a little more crass than how I was going to put it. I'm all for. Go ahead, Cox.
I do have a quick counter to that. What I will say, because
he can't counter his summary.
No. Well, what I will say in response to that summary, though, I'll say something that gets said. I saw it referred to about the Steam sale currently, and about Warframe, a game that I play, because they just released some premium stuff that's for sale right now, but they have some other issues going on, is you vote with your wallet. So if you don't like a business practice from a particular corporation, or if you don't like a business practice from a particular entity, don't support it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I will point out that the only reason these people can go on eBay and get the kind of money that they get for some of this stuff is because people will pay it. You know, that's the issue. So stop paying them so that it's not profitable. Because I see people in Europe a lot. Like, for example, there'll be a limited edition pops and stuff like that come out over here. And there's somebody in Australia, there's somebody in Europe who wants that, or Canada even. We see that a lot with Canada. It doesn't become available in their country, and they want it. And so their only course is to go on eBay or to go onto a forum or something and find someone who can physically buy it for them where it's available and have it shipped to them. And so there's no shame, in my opinion, in flipping something for a couple extra bucks, because that's, you know, it's not necessarily just a supply issue. It's just a, you know, localization issue. But, you know, obviously if you're marking something up like many hundreds of times, you're getting into that super greedy territory. But at the same time, it's like some of the stuff it's gone and then it never comes back. You know what I mean? So it's really hard to moralize the whole thing, is what I will say.
Chris, you have a rebuttal, sir?
No.
Okay, just making sure, because, you know, it was your summary. All right. But I like what you said. I would love to hear Frank Allen from Toy Power really kind of do a quick summary of his point on it.
I want to hear Frank talk about tariffs and shipping and all that stuff for Australia.
Well, they do talk about that some on their show, but they've talked about how they do have to go to aftermarket. And sometimes, for the same argument we're having with Nintendo, sometimes the companies make the packs weird, or they require you to buy it in a certain way, or they break it up in weird ways, and that's not profitable in the sense of making money for them, profitable in the definition of the word of they're trying to build their collection and have value for themselves in their own collection, not necessarily monetary value. And when you make it hard to get it, it's not profitable to them to add it to their collection, even though they want it and they're missing it, you're kind of screwing them. So I'd like to hear his two cents. My last word on this is that providing a service, providing, like you were saying, Klaus, a way to help somebody out that can't get it, or to be in an open market saying, I put in all the work and effort, I got the Xbox One, I'm going to turn around and resell it at an honest rate. And what you do with it, you do. If you make it, if you pay me $2,000 when I was asking for $400, that's not me, that's you. Mm-hmm. You know, stop spending the money. But with Nintendo in this case, with the NES Classic specifically, it sold out constantly. To any businessman, you want your product to sell out, you keep reordering, you keep putting it out there until the market wanes. They didn't do that. They made an artificially shorted market. And anybody, the scalpers who sweep the shelves, the scalpers who buy the max amount they can of a ticket and then resell it, the people who are profiteers, meaning they artificially are underhanded and they make a short market when there was never going to be one, that bothers me on any level. And Honestly, I don't know why Nintendo's doing it. It makes no business sense. You sell out of your product, you're making profits, is a fair price on it. You're not jacking up the profit yourself. Now, wouldn't that be interesting if it came out, if WikiLeaks got a hold of Nintendo stuff, and it turns out Nintendo was the one buying them their own gear and selling it on eBay for $3,000?
You say that, but there's a certain tabletop.
You know, I just say, now we're diving into other stuff. But one last thing about Nintendo, because I think we can have an interesting discussion on this before we hit this break, is they just came out, Reggie Fils and me literally just came out and said Nintendo believes that the audience for 4K gaming is too limited. And before we really discuss that, I want to point out this is a company that didn't put HD in until almost 10 years after HD was common in the household. You know, Wii U finally, and it's not even true HD. It's like 720 or something HD on the Wii U. The Switch even touted 1080p or 1080i, whichever one they touted. It's like, no, the next gen is 4K. Why are you so far behind? What do we think about their legitimate open stance? Then I'm going to read the quote. The Nintendo mission is to reach as many consumers as possible, to have them engage and have fun with our intellectual property. That's what we try and do. So inherently, we go for the more mainstream audience. Inherently, we want our products to be affordable. We want our products to be easy to pick up and experience. Low learning curve. I want our IP to shine as we deliver these experiences. Now, I believe when he says to pick up, he means literally grab the controller and jump in and play, not buy.
No, I just think it's because really obviously, funny that he says that.
Yeah.
The way we're talking about.
And to those statements, I will say Nintendo has been true. Inherently, anybody can pick up that controller and figure it out. Those were stories all over about senior citizens' homes doing the Wii, because of the activities and people were playing it. You know, their products are always less than their competitors. However, you just barely got the 1080, man. To me, you're lagging behind. Chris, I'm gonna let you go first. What is your take on their stance that there's not a market for 4K?
Honestly, when you're talking graphics and display graphics in these Nintendo systems, I think they're really just still feeling gun shy after Virtual Boy, because it's something they adopted fairly early, and the market said nah. So
sure.
It's always been able to work on all televisions. It's just not going up to that full resolution. So does it look bad when you're not at 4K on a non-4K television? Does it look bad? It doesn't look as good, but it's nothing that it's ever. It's not like you're going through coax, I guess is where I'm at. It's not like you're doing an audio visual. It's not like you're doing an AV port versus your 4K port. Then I think there would be problems. But I think when it comes to stuff like that, I think there are things that they've had in their past that didn't pan out well enough that they think we'd rather be a little late to market. And in the case of HDMI, a lot late to the market. But
a lot late, yeah.
Yeah,
I agree with Chris here. I think that Nintendo has decided that their business strategy is to kind of be the remora to the Xbox and PlayStation shark, and just kind of like, let's gobble up the scraps, you know what I mean? Because they know they're going to, like, their big titles like Mario and Zelda, whatever console they end up being on, they're going to sell, because they have such wide appeal with both youngin and old players and collectors and all of that. So they don't necessarily have to aim to be on the cutting edge of the technology. And I kind of support them in that, because it allows them to occupy their niche. What I will say, though, is it's really foolish for him to come out and say that, you know, the 4K thing is too small, because that's only a snapshot of what's going on today. You know what I mean?
It does say in this article, I think I just closed the article, but it did say that projections, I don't know who projected it, what company, but projections show by 2019 only a 35% market saturation of 4K. But aren't you future-proofing if you get that now? I don't know. I mean, is HDMI long enough tail that it'll be fine?
Yeah, well, okay, so 10 years ago, 720 was king, 1080 was overkill, right? That was where we were at about a decade ago. And you heard people be like, I don't need that. Well, you know, that's not going to hold up forever. I remember I worked in electronic sales at the time, and I told people, I was like, you're going to want 720p at least. That's what you're going to want. You're going to want that sometime in the next couple of years because, you know, at that point, we're getting to the point where Blu-ray pretty much just won the console war, you know, or the format war with a HD DVD.
And then, yep.
And you know what I mean? And it was like people were starting to transition their DVD / VHS collections into high def video, you know, Blu-ray. Go where it is. Because that's the other thing is we see it in PC gaming too. The big threshold that everybody shoots for is 60 frames a second. People want that all the time. And now, there's arguments. Scientifically, we know that the human eye can only perceive things at up to 30 frames per second on average. But the thing is, at 60 frames, it just, we don't notice every single thing that's being projected at 60 frames, but it smooths the whole experience for us. You know what I mean? It gives the appearance that everything looks a lot better because everything flows a lot better. So we might not be, you know, right with it. And I would say the same thing about 4K resolution is it's probably overkill for the average consumer right now, but I would say by this time in 2027, it's going to be the standard, or it's going to be the old standard. You know what I mean? It's going to be what 720 is to us now. I don't know what the limit is, you know, on resolution. I don't know when we're going to reach that threshold where it's like, we literally cannot refine resolution any further to make it look any better for the human eye without cyborg implants. You know what I mean?
I'm down.
And there's absolutely got to be a plateau for that. You know, we just haven't found it quite yet. And 4K might be that plateau. We might be getting close to it. So,
well, they are working on 6K and 10K TVs, but we don't know. We don't know yet.
So what I will say is, you know, I'm reminded of in 2005, I worked at Best Buy at the time. I went to a conference with Intel and one of the printer manufacturers. I can't remember which one. But it was Intel, one of the printer manufacturers, and I think another company like Microsoft or something. It was a little, basically a product demo thing. And they were talking about the new Pentium dual cores that had just come out, dual core processors. And one of my coworkers raised his hand and said, do you guys anticipate having dual cores with hyper-threading? Which is, for the folks at home who aren't really computer buffs, dual core means there's two physical processors that work independently but at the same time. And hyper-threading is theoretical processors where a single physical processor runs multiple operations at the same time. What he was asking for was basically quad core computing out of two physical processors. And the representative laughed at him. And I'll never forget this because he laughed at him and he's like, nobody will ever need that. 4 years later, that was the industry standard. You know what I mean? Like, and that's why I hesitate to support anybody saying anything along those lines. Like, don't make bold statements about where technology is going. It's okay to not be on the cutting edge of where, you know, technology is right now or is going to be in the next couple of years, but don't pretend like that won't be the standard someday, because I'm sure people were at one time sitting on a pile of VHS who thought that there would never be a better medium for their movies than a VHS tape. And I'm sure there's a whole slew of people who have a huge CD collection that feel like they would never have a better, you know, medium for CDs or for music than CDs. And here we are. And, you know, people laugh when somebody buys a CD nowadays. You know what I mean? Like, good luck finding a car that even has a CD player if it's relatively new, late model. So that's all I'm saying is just, I don't think any of these companies should really be trying to, like, elitist shame anybody and be like, oh, that's so ridiculous. Like, just shut your mouth. Like, be like, we've decided to target this area and just be accessible to everybody and not have to worry about that stuff. And that's completely okay.
Yeah, I agree.
Because as kind of an auxiliary concept to this, there was also in the last week, there was a comment made by a game developer. I forget which game it was for and which studio it was, where they were talking about how they developed the game for the PlayStation 4 and how they felt very held back by that because they basically said developing for the PlayStation 4 is like trying to develop for a PC from 5 years ago. And they're not wrong. You know, the PlayStation 4 is not a young system anymore. It's definitely in its midlife. You know,
it's about 5 to 6 years old.
Right. Yeah. But at the same time, it's kind of like, well, I hear you, but that's the nature of the console beast. I mean, that as a PC gamer, primarily PC gamer, that's what we've been saying for 20 years is we're like, we play PC games because, and whenever possible, because we can upgrade our computer every year or two if we have to. We can stay with technology, and we don't even necessarily have to stay with the cutting edge of technology. You know, you can put a couple hundred dollars into your machine every year to stay current to like what the standard is. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. that might sound like a lot to a lot of people who are looking at a $300 console as a ideal choice, but that's the thing is you put that $300 into that console today, that console has, you know, it'll never be better than it is right now. You know what I mean? It's a snapshot in time. And so that's something you have to take into consideration, but that's what people are getting into. So,
and Chris, what you got?
Nothing to add to that.
Sorry.
No.
Didn't mean to run on like that for.
You answered my question because as now I can look at Nintendo in a slightly different light. Okay, you're right. It is fine to be safe on the tech level of we know this works. We saturate the market. We try to get in everybody's homes. I've been a proud owner of Nintendo products ever since they've come out. Mm-hmm. I haven't had every console, but I've had a console or a device of theirs in my home since Nintendo hit the American shores. So I do love it, but I get that. I say, okay, you're gonna take chances and oh, we're gonna do this new controlling system. And we saw Sony and Xbox try to catch up and fail at it. They really nailed it with their controllers. I loved the Wii. I really did. I loved all of it. The Wii U, they tried a new thing. Let's incorporate tablet technology. Not as much, but they still are good. And we see that the other devices aren't really trying to do that. Fine. Okay, but yeah, I'm with you. Don't make bold statements because honestly, you make me go, do I really want the Switch or whatever's next? Because you're obviously thinking that tech follows you. Tech doesn't follow you. You follow tech with some interesting little sidesteps. Mm-hmm. Some of them work. Some of them don't. Can we say, you know, the power glove, anybody? Or Virtual Boy? Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, Chris mentioned Virtual Boy. That was so far ahead of its time. It was 20 years ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. And here we are at the height of VR being a potential serious mainstream thing in the next few years. It might fizzle out again. We don't know. And sometimes certain aspects of technology face barriers that we can't anticipate. Like one of the big issues with VR, for example, is motion sickness for people. It's really hard to zero it in where most people can use a headset, particular mm-hmm. headset, and play certain games without getting sick. It's something that happened to, I've mentioned Warframe a lot as a game that I play off and on. They have a personal jetpack type game mode that is in space, and they changed the controls recently to be free flowing, like if you were actually, you know, piloting a little mini jetpack spaceship in your, you know, in space. And the new control change made a lot of people motion sick. And so there are people who don't want to even use that game mode at all. They're like, oh, no, I can't. I get sick. I want to throw up. You know what I mean? And so you can really alienate and ostracize people sometimes. And that can definitely be a problem. You know what I mean? So you got to be careful where you go with the technology and not overstep sometimes. And so it's okay to be cautious. Just don't try to alienate, you know, the cutting edge audience, like your extreme adopters, you know, because they will turn on you and they'll crucify you in the court of public opinion if you do such things.
Fair enough. All right, we've got the ad break here coming up, but come back, we've got Han Solo stuff to talk about and some Michael Bay Transformers stuff to talk about. So stick around, we'll be back. And we're back, just like those awesome two directors that were doing Han Solo. Oh wait, no, they didn't get to come back to set for Han Solo, did they? So, Chris, tell us what's going on. What am I going to get my Han Solo film? What's going on?
Well, at this point, it's a question of which Han Solo film you're going to get and when you're going to get it. These are enigmas wrapped inside of riddles, inside of questions. It's crazy what's going on the set of this movie right now. And I think there's this confluence of events that we've seen over the last few years that are all coming to a head, not just in Star Wars, but I think comic book movies in general are starting to feel some of this. But the news here is that the directors for Phil Lord and Chris Miller of 21 Jump Street, 22 Jump Street fame have been let go from the project.
Sorry to stop you. Okay, 21 and 22 Jump Street. I didn't see 22 Jump Street. 21 Jump Street was cheesy. It was okay. But I would reference a better movie of the Lego movie.
The Lego movie, absolutely.
Yeah, it was a way better product than those to compare to.
See, I really like the Jump Street series.
I didn't say it was bad.
I went in there to laugh, and that's exactly what I did through those movies. So
Fair enough.
They were so referential and so tongue-in-cheek, and that those movies were meant to do nothing but make fun of themselves. And it just like the Lego
movie.
Just like the Lego movie. And these guys do that really well. So what it sounds like is they were trying to do a little too much of that in the humor that they were doing with the Han Solo movie, to the point that the studio had to come out once they started seeing dailies come back. Kathleen Kennedy was not happy. They sent producers in. Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote the script, this is also the guy that wrote and directed Empire Strikes Back. So there's some gravitas there with Lawrence Kasdan's name, especially in the Star Wars community, that you really don't need to do a lot to make his stuff better. And when you're breaking from his script to the point where it's displeasing him and he feels the need to go to Kathleen, there's a very definite problem. So I know one article that I read last week alluded to the fact that it may have been the actor, Alden, I butcher his name every time, Ehrenreich, who's playing Han Solo, that he had gone to Kathleen and said that, hey, you really need to start taking a look at this because it's starting to get a little Ace Ventura-ish. And that's probably not a description you want to a Star Wars movie, is that it's got Ace Ventura feel to it. Right. So I have no problem with the studio pumping the brakes and saying, hey, what's going on? I don't necessarily have a problem with directors standing up and saying, hey, this is the movie we want to make. Of course, you're going to suffer the consequences, such as happened. Let me jump in.
This is one of the few articles I read. Chris is amazing at finding articles and sharing them in the group. What he puts out in public is like a tenth of what he shares in the group. So I read maybe one every 20 articles that he puts up, unless we're going to talk about on the show. But this one, because you hit it so hard, and the clots just went, wow. And then Audrey Kearns of Booze and Phasers, of all people, jumped in with that great All of a Sudden in Philadelphia dumpster fire, well, toilet fire gif going on. I hate you so much for that gif.
I'm on your side, Charles. It's Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff. Anyway, no, let's not start that argument again. I did it so we could move on. That's why, okay, I need to read this. And I'm reading through it, and some of the stuff I get as just business, as creative differences when you're co-creating, it didn't work. But my thing always jumped out at me. The major Lord and Miller credits are the Lego movie and 21 Jump Street. When I think Han Solo, I don't think Emmett from Lego movie, right? I don't think referential comedy. Those are comedies, flat out, without a doubt, funny movies. Lego movie was great. I've never heard anybody complain about it. Maybe there are people, I'm sure there's always are, but it's a fine film. I loved it with my kids. I loved it without my kids. I liked Lego Batman movie, which is in the same franchise, but not necessarily the same directors. Doesn't matter. 21 Jump Street, I did watch it, Chris. I did laugh. That's what I went in there for. I laughed at it. I thought it was funny. But the thing is, their style is self-referential humor, which I love. When I watch Han Solo, I want it to be more, I'm having a hard time coming up with a legitimate film that you guys will get behind going, yeah, that kind of feel. So the only thing I can come up with is Battleship Troopers, where it was cheesy. I don't want cheesy campy of the Battleship Troopers, but what they did was I went expecting a cheesy campy movie and got actors who took it seriously. And it was fun to feel like you're in the middle of the space war with a little bit of cheesiness on top of it. When we see Han Solo, our first introduction to Han Solo is his cockiness of, well, okay, shooting the guy, there's that. But the cockiness of I made the Kessel Run, and I don't want to butcher it because I know all the geeks will yell at me. So fill in the blank yourself. But that was his thing, right, is that he's this dude. And while there's some humor, and what I mean by dude, he's like this badass, right? Even though there's some humor about hitting the control panel to make it work with Chewie mouthing off to him, those kind of things. it's not a comedy at all. So, Chris, would you say that as talented as Lord Miller might be, was this just a really bad choice of directors to do a Han Solo film?
I don't know that I could say that, because okay. that's foregoing the ability for directors to grow and spread their wings. Otherwise, Michael Key would not have directed, was it Get Out?
What did he do before Get Out? I remember.
Key and Peele? And now he's going to end.
Oh, that Michael Key. My bad. Sorry. You're right.
So I don't know that it's...
It was actually Jordan Peele.
Jordan Peele. Yeah. I don't know. Just based on that, it's hard to say that, because, like I said, you're not assuming that a director can grow and has other creative outlets that they can do. You don't know what guys can do serious and what guys can do the drama or the comedy.
Fair enough. Now reading through this. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Paul.
I was going to say, two of the big takeaways that I took out of the article was that Kathleen's choice in those directors was that she's trying to choose people, like you were just saying, Chris, that can kind of like bring something special and also maybe grow into what they're looking for. So it's almost like she's trying to choose people that maybe don't fit the bill for a heavy-handed, heavily controlled IP normally, but they want to see what they can do with it. And I think in this case, what they pointed out is that they like to rely on a lot of improv is one of the problems.
Yeah, they said that brought out the actor's best performance.
Right. The problem is you can't really improv most of Star Wars. There's so much about Star Wars that is so important to get right. You know, like continuity issues and stuff like that. Like, things have to be very specific a lot of times, because they're not just telling a single film story. They're telling, you know, a installment in the epic saga that will go down in history as being the Star Wars story, you know? And so and this is a key character in the main trilogy. So, like, you know, they were talking about, what's the gentleman's name who did Rogue One? Was it Gareth? It was Edwards. They talked about how, you know, Gareth Edwards was kind of inexperienced. And when they realized that he was kind of, you know, floundering a bit, they offered to send in some support, and he was very open to that. And so he received that support with wide open arms, and they collaborated to end up with the end result, which came out quite good. And, you know, people who, like in the article, people who were involved with that said, you know, you can see a lot of Gareth's work in there. You know, it's not like somebody came in and just whitewashed the whole thing. Not whitewashed racially, but, you know, whitewashed in terms of just making it all very bland and, you know, two expectations. So it was really more of a thing where, like, the project was a lot bigger than the initial choice was really qualified for, and they made it work. In this case, these guys weren't receptive at all to that kind of support and that kind of encouragement and, you know, prodding, basically.
Now, I would be interested to hear from Audrey or Brian D. Bradley, her husband, who is a Hollywood writer, from a writer standpoint, their take. Because I know Brian, as a writer, created a show, as a partner, so they co-created it. And then he was the showrunner. But that's not always the case, right? Sometimes you'll write the script, and we know there's tons of stories where even Kevin Smith wrote the script, submitted it, studio said thanks, paid him, bye, and it went on to other people, and the movie totally changed or whatever, or maybe it never made it. When I read that, what's his name? The writer here that you just referenced, Kasdan. When he was upset, I'm like, I don't care. Because as a creator, if I'm directing it, I want to put my spin on it. Now, the other stuff that they quoted was when apparently in a normal day when you shoot, you'll do 10 to 15 shots. And I've been an extra on a set, even for the little TV BS stuff that I've done. They'll do one scene 15 times. And we'll have to walk the same path 15 times because they change the cameras over. They do different angles. It's for editing purposes. And Lord Miller, actually, on one specific day that they're referencing here, one of the last days that they were on set, it wasn't until the afternoon that they started shooting. And, you know, it was like a 6 o'clock call time, because that's typically what happens on a closed set. And they only, by the end of the day, they only shot three shots. Well, that's a huge waste of resources.
If I read that article correctly, it's not that they were only shooting three shots. It's that they would have three. The difference is they would have like 10 to 15 cameras set up at multiple angles for each take.
So I missed that somewhere in the article.
Right,
sorry.
And what they were doing is only doing like three angles. So one of the frustrations...
Okay, so instead of three shots, there are three angles. Still, yeah, I got you.
But basically that it was... Because the comment was that when they were looking at the dailies, there was nothing to work with. They had like no raw material to try to sculpt something that they could salvage out of all of that. You know, because that's the whole thing is when you've got 15 cameras running on X number of takes, you can piece magic together. You know what I mean? Like you can make almost anything look good if you're talented enough. You know what I mean? If everything's on point and it's not a huge, like, you know, unfixable issue with a particular scene or whatever, you can fix it one way or another. It might not, you know, people might be able to pick out the seams of the, you know, the emergency stitches, if you know what I mean. Like, cause good critique often does that. They'll pick apart a particular scene and be like, it's one of the big, things that really, when people rag on like a lot of modern action movies with the jump cuts, the like insane amount of jump cuts when it jumps like 15 times at a 20-second scene, it's because they don't have, they're not doing good practical effects, or they don't have good shots or good angles, and so they're just like they're obfuscating the badness by making it jump around so much that you can't track it. So that, I guess that was the big issue in this case, was that they weren't being comprehensive enough, and so there wasn't really any raw material to try to shape into something usable.
Chris, what do you got? What do you think?
So other two issues in the movie, or the three in this whole deal, is one, the actor, again, Alden. Alden.
That's it. No, you got it right. Alden.
Yeah. Aaron. Yeah. So he's not. There's question as to whether or not he's as good as they hoped he would be. There's talk of acting coaches coming on, which is not out of the norm. Their acting coaches come in on set all the time, but it seems like some pushback from Lord Miller saying, well, he was not up to snuff like we hoped he would be. There's question as to whether or not Kathleen is too involved in the day-to-day operations of the films and whether or not they can let go. And this comes back to one of those big things is the DCU has said it, Marvel has said it, and Star Wars has said it, that we want directors that can give us their vision of this universe, but we know that there are limits. There are boundaries, very distinct boundaries that they're going to have to meet. And so people want to know what happened to Christopher Nolan's, where are those R2 directors that are going to have their own vision on film. And when you are universe building, you don't get that luxury. You can tweak something. You might be able to get a little piece of yourself into that universe, but you are not going to have full creative control of these movies. And that's an unrealistic expectation of any writer, director, actor going into these movies when you're universe building. That power is ultimately going to rest with your exec producers and likely studio heads. I think in the case of Star Wars and MCU, where they benefit is with Kathleen and Kevin Feige, you have people that understand the vision, have a very good vision and an established vision. DCEU, still early in the universe to be saying for sure. But I don't know, for when people say that maybe she's too involved and that Disney came in over the top, there's a time when that's going to happen, and everybody has to understand that this isn't necessarily a part of the studio getting involved and being too heavy-handed. I think,
yeah, I to back that up, Chris, I would point out that you got to look at a Feige and you got to look at a Kathleen Kennedy and realize that level of control has produced results, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like these are people who are tried and true. They are proven as masters of being able to craft these shared universes. You know what I mean? These are people who are really good at keeping everything on point and being cohesive. So to try to criticize that, I feel like is really irresponsible of this director team. You know what I mean? Because clearly they know what they're doing. Like, because then when you do look at the DCEU, for example, that's probably one of the problems over there, is that there's not enough cohesion, or that cohesion is coming from somebody largely, or well, two people largely, the Snyders, that are not, they don't seem to have the right vision to execute what they're trying to execute in a way that resonates with people. But Kathleen Kennedy and Kevin Feige have proven that they do. So I would welcome that if I were a director on a big film like a Star Wars film, or I just wouldn't take that job. You know what I mean? Like there's no paycheck in Hollywood worth floundering and doing a subpar job on a huge film like that and having it ruin you, because it can. You know what I mean? How many people yeah. had their careers ruined by overreaching and underdelivering? You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah, and when you have that latitude, when you're able to have somebody else set your parameters, and as long as you don't go outside those left right boundaries, sometimes it can be an issue, but it also allows you to take your mind off of what's too far. Because you have somebody that's going to reel you in. You don't have to worry about going too far off the reservation. Somebody's going to let you know, and then all you got to do is dial it back. It's whether or not you can adjust to that.
And to particularly address their personal style, where they like to do a lot of improv and ad-libbing and that sort of thing, there's no reason why you can't go set up the shot, shoot the shot, you know, mm-hmm. verbatim from the script a bunch of times to make sure you get it, and then experiment a little bit. The best people do that. We hear about that all the time. You know what I mean? So it's not to say that, like, Kathleen Kennedy or Kevin Feige aren't going to be open to seeing an alternative version of a scene and being like, oh, you know what? You know, you nailed it there. You guys got it. Let's use that. Because that can happen. But, yeah, you can't be trying to improv a Star Wars movie. That's just... Mm-hmm. That's insanity. Right. You're asking to get run off the set, and that's what happened. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, this might be an actual true case of creative differences that it just could mm-hmm. not get past.
Yeah. I know initial articles that I saw last week said something. There was a quote about Kathleen didn't even like the way they folded their socks when they were trying to paint her as the bad guy. And I'm like, come on.
So that's dumb. Who cares yeah. about that? Yeah.
I don't see Kathleen Kennedy being that petty.
Yeah.
No.
I mean,
well,
George Lucas, sure. But.
You know who is petty? You guys and your hatred of Transformers. I'm just saying, it's, you know, time to move on. Be bigger people. So you wanted to bring this up very quickly because I know that Transformers opened up to the all-time low for the franchise for opening weekend. Don't care. Still want to see it. I know that Mark Wahlberg is done. That's okay. I like you, Marky Mark. I'll watch you into some other stuff. That's where Matthew Lillard came up in discussion earlier. I'd watch Matthew Lillard. I like him in stuff. You know, I'd watch him in this. I watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, even though it still had Megan Fox in it. So I'm just saying. But you wanted to talk about possibly because of the low performance that Michael Bay might be done with the Transformers franchise.
The article, and there's a litany of articles out there right now that kind of point to Michael Bay going, Marky Mark going, they're both going, one's possibly going to stay while Mark Wahlberg is out. Who knows? I think, you know, we discussed a little bit before, and I think Paul had a very a good point that the low performance of this film gave them the out. So whether Michael gets out as the director, I'm sure he's still going to stay on as an exec. But he won't, if he doesn't direct, I don't think he's going to lose any sleep over not directing these movies. I'm sure at a certain point, even Michael Bay gets tired of hearing the hate.
Yeah. I mean, and who knows? I mean, after every project, maybe he's like, I'm done with this. And that's actually what Mark Wahlberg rather said was, you know, Bay says after every Transformer film that he's kind of done, but that he's kind of running the whole show himself. And that's the thing, and you know, it's like I do BTP every week. I just feel like, you know, next week is going to be the last week, and I run it all by myself. You guys bring nothing to the table. I'm just saying. I wish you would help out a little more.
Yeah.
But, no, that's obviously from their laughter. You know, that's not true. But I don't care. You know, as long as they make fun films where robots show up on screen, because for me, it's not about the story. And I think for any fan of the series of movies, it's not about the story. It's not about what you think you can do with it. Am I going to get awesome looking robots on the screen? The answer is yes. Here's my money. So, you know,
you were the one person that went to Chappie?
Actually, I've not seen Chappie yet. I'd like to, just because it looked really cool. But the other part of me goes, the story looks like crap. But, you know, whatever. I did go see... what's the other one along the lines of Chappie? A South African film. The District 9?
District 9, yeah.
District 9. I did go to see that because it looked cool. It actually turned out to be an amazing story, actually. on that case. So anything else, gentlemen, before we get out of here?
No.
All right. Well, Chris is going to have to go and get some back rubs to Klotz because, you know, they're not used to not getting along. Usually it's the two of them yelling at me, and I can take it, you know, the two of them yelling at each other. And that's why you heard me laughing. Honestly, if Mike doesn't edit it out, there's points where you two are, like, yelling. I'm just chuckling, like, I'm glad it's not me this time. This time you two are, like, going at it. That's great. Great discussion. And we reiterate with breaking the panel, everybody has a right to their own opinion. And some of the stuff Chris argued or the questions he brought up were good. Some of the stuff that Klaus says obviously was good. I agree with some on both sides of it. And we can all disagree as long as we can just have a civil conversation. And that's what Breaking the Panel is all about. If you'd like to be a part of that, if you want to email us, btp@giantsizeteamup.com. Facebook is Breaking the Panel. Twitter's @PanelBreakers. I don't believe we have an Instagram at all. And if you are one of the Uber elite, that's, you know, I make a voice because I'm making fun of you, but that's still on Google+. We're on Google+ as well under Giant Size Team Up Network. Go check it out. Until next week, come back and hear Christopher say,
when asked why Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite wouldn't have X-Men, the producers said, "We talked with Marvel very closely about their future roadmap, but about what's going to be happening. Your modern Marvel fan, maybe they don't even remember some of the X-Men characters."
Breaking the Panel is the flagship podcast on the Giant Size Team Up Network. You can support the show at patreon.com/breakingthepanel, and you'll find more of our amazing podcasts at giantsizeteamup.com.